Hi there, and welcome to Everyday Business with me, Aidan Donnelly. I've been analysing and investing in companies for nearly 30 years, and I'm fascinated by how companies operate, the entrepreneurs who start them, and the business people and managements that run them. In this podcast, I'll be talking to a whole host of people with different stories, backgrounds, and journeys, learning about their businesses and gleaning some insights and lessons from their experience. For those that are listening, don't forget to like, share, and subscribe if you enjoy what you hear. So without further ado to today's episode. Paul McCann first joined Grant Thornton in 2001 and over the next 11 years amassed extensive financial advisory experience. From 2012 to 2017, he served two terms as managing partner, navigating the firm through an accelerating growth period, expanding from 417 to 1,144 people and growing revenues from 41 million to 116 million. Paul took over as CEO of Ergo in September 2021, bringing with him a reputation in corporate finance for an exceptional grasp of business value and strategies for sustaining growth. Ergo deliver high quality and reliable IT services that add value and efficiency to their operations. They help their clients achieve their goals and overcome their pain points with their agile and customer-centric approach, empowering clients to embrace change and seize new opportunities with cutting-edge and scalable IT services. In addition to internal directorships, he's held non-executive roles, creating boardroom environments that value constructive debate and avoid groupthink. Paul, you're very welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Aidan.
Right. A nice, easy one to start off. Why does somebody with an MSc in manufacturing systems engineer end up training to be an accountant after college?
Well, it's actually an easy answer. It's back in 92, 93, I'm sure you remember, Aidan, yourself, Ireland wasn't the Ireland we know today. There was very little work at the time. I did a master's in manufacturing systems up in Queens, loved it, but there wasn't much opportunities. In fact, I think there was a bit of a recession around 92, if you remember. So I did the walk of shame and became an accountant.
Went to the dark side. A lot of business owners and CEOs that I've interviewed have tended to have accountancy as their foundation, right? Why is this, and what do you think it adds?
I didn't want to be an accountant, right? So, just to say that, and I would have been a reluctant accountant, but I would be a huge convert, if you like, in giving advice to younger people as a profession. I think it's a great qualification. You can travel the world. It enables you to understand businesses and how they work in terms of sales, in terms of accounting, in terms of the balance sheet, in terms of funding, in terms of financing. So I think it's a great start to your career. And, you know, everybody goes off and does different things, but I think it's a really, really good qualification. And as you always say, like, CEOs in the States are salespeople, CEOs in Germany are engineers, and CEOs in Ireland are accountants. You know, it is, I agree with you, it is a thing.
Your career has gone from kind of large company to small company or smaller company. Do you have a preference?
I think there's a freedom and agility to being with some you know, a company. Well, small, Ergo isn't small, but it's Irish owned. And as I always say to people, look, we decide what happens. We get to make the decisions. We're not waiting for a memo from New York or London. There's huge freedom in that. Mm. And I'd always say, you know, if we're not happy with something, guys, do you know what the beauty of this is? We can just change it.
And not have to send 10 memos up the channel.
Exactly. So don't worry about it. Yeah. Obviously, bigger companies, I love the scale of big companies and what you can achieve with that scale and size. But, you know, inevitably there's bureaucracy as well, mm-hmm. you know.
And I suppose when you're operating in an industry that tends to be reasonably fast moving, having that ability to be agile and chop and change, and, you know, if it doesn't work, you know, tick it off, move on to the next thing.
Yeah, do something else.
Yeah. When you took on the managing partner of Grant Thornton, you were very young, probably one of the youngest, I'd say. Did you know then that you would be gone after your two terms?
I didn't think about it. Right, you know, people have said to me, you know, you did it the wrong way around. You should have had it later in your career and it would have seen you out, you know, a bit like Terence O'Rourke and Fergal O'Rourke, you know, and then you go into different things then. But it's, you know, things happen at different times. You've got to just accept it. And I got it young and I wouldn't change it. But it does make it hard for you to stay, I think, for a long period of time after you finish it, you know. I would agree.
And did you did that factor into your decision to take it in, to take it up, or were you just kind of going, like, I don't know, what is the decision process for managing part? You just get a tap on the shoulder and go, you're it.
Well, what happens is, you know, there's a few partners, senior partners would get together and ask you to, are you interested in it and that you'd have support? That's how it happens. No, I mean, you don't think, well, in 9 years' time, will I be back in rank and file and unhappy? You don't necessarily think of that. You know what I mean? If it comes your way, you take it, you know, and which is what I did.
And, you know, when you were going through that process and kind of knew that there was going to be, you know, a life after managing partner, when did you start thinking about the plan for that life after managing partner?
About a year out, right. You know, you're just thinking about what part of the practice I'd like to go back into. I went back into the financial services practice, huge amount of growth at the time. It was really, really good. I had really great clients at the time. I had PTSB Bank, I had Northern Trust. And it was like there was nothing wrong, if you like, with that part of it. The only thing that was wrong, I suppose, was when you're used to kind of driving at the front of the bus, and next thing you find yourself in the middle of the bus, you sort of say to yourself, right, is this it then?
Yeah.
Am I going to be here for the rest of my career? So I sort of said, look, while I still want to lead, let's see if there's something else.
Yeah. And at that point, was it always going to be something outside of accountancy?
I think so. Oh, yeah. No, I think so. I think I'd be running out of town if I joined another accountancy practice. Yeah, no, it would have been something else, some other sector. Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Switching then to Ergo, I suppose the you know, when people talk about entrepreneurs, they always tend to start focusing on, you know, starting a business, right, as opposed to scaling a business. And I think there's a big difference between the two. So, you know, what do you think are the key facets for a CEO who's going to scale a business as opposed to start a business?
Yeah, I mean, I think scaling, there's definitely differences. Invariably, when you're scaling, there is already a culture in place. So you have to take that and see if you can improve on it or maybe set greater ambition. But it's, yeah, there's differences. It's you have to influence a lot more. In a startup, you can nearly do everything yourself. You can nearly sell, you know, so about nearly by force of nature, you can actually achieve what you want to in the startup to a certain level. But in scaling, you've got to convince everyone, okay, guys, you know, we're happy where we're at, where we are, or we've got to where we are, but are we up for this? You know, do we want to grow? Are we happy with this? Is this a lifestyle here, or are we happy to sort of say, okay, we're going to try and grow into new markets or develop something new or create a kind of momentum with everyone that we want to do something different, you know?
And when you were stepping into that role as CEO, how important is it that, you know, when you look at it and you examine the culture that's there already, that you feel it is either A, something you're very happy with, or B, something that if you're not completely happy with it, at least you can work with in that time?
Yeah. How I came across Ergo was I advised Ergo back in 2007. I advised the MBO team and John Purdy when they bought out the one of the original founders, Tim Sheehy. And I liked them. Like, they were all good fun, very grounded. So I got a sense of the culture, and it would be very me, you know. Right. It'd be very, you know, don't take yourself too seriously, have a bit of fun, work hard. So I kind of knew that I wasn't going into something completely bonkers, yeah. You know. I had enough of a feel of the place that I'd be at least comfortable with that side of it, you know.
And then I suppose, and it's a question that always happens with private companies more so than anything else, you know, if you want someone to act like an owner of a business, you know, in terms of staff, you've got to make them an owner of a business. Now, you know, if you're a publicly listed company, you very easy make somebody an owner. But then again, you're so big that any individual is not going to make a difference. So when it comes to that private company, you know, how do you instill that ethos of, you know, we're all owners here and we're all out for the best outcome for the company?
Yeah. Obviously, you have share incentives that can work. But I would always say, you know, not so much that you create a cause, but I would always say, whether I was with Grant Thornton or Ergo, our competitors are much bigger and got much more resources than us, right? So there's no passengers here. Mm. And if you want an easier life, with respect and with good grace, there's the door.
Door, yeah.
So we're trying to go somewhere, and we need everyone with their sleeves rolled up. And you can create that, you know, and people respond to that, you know. I would say, particularly with Ergo, there's a lot of people in Ergo that have been around a long time and are very, very passionate about it and committed to it. And that's what you want. You want people who are going to, you know, go in and start swinging for you, you know?
Yeah. And I suppose you see it too, that clarity of purpose, not only from the CEO, but all the way down, is so crucial in terms of success.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, culture is what you do when no one's looking. Mm. There's people who go through brick walls for Ergo and they need to, right? Because we're up against, in our marketplace, you know, we've had new entrants in recent years like EY with the might of all of their resources. So we need everybody. We need everybody up for the fight. Mm.
But it also means that you've got to work smart rather than work hard.
Yeah. We got to go into the right areas. We got to see where we can win and what's our right to win. I think we do that.
In the context of Ergo, and I suppose when you stepped into it, and as you said, you'd known the business beforehand, but like when you look at a lot of companies, you know, to get to a destination in the future, you know, you've got to kind of set the sat nav and push the pedal, right? If you can't do one without the other. If you push the pedal and you don't set the sat nav, you're still in the driveway. If you don't set the, you know, if you're not pushing the pedal, you're not going anywhere. So it's that idea of having not only the vision of where you want to go, but the ability and the wherewithal to get there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. I think with Ergo, you know, we have a couple of really important traditions. You know, we're a very strong Microsoft partner. We've been Microsoft Partner of the Year many times. With some recent acquisitions, we're very, very important to Dell, very, very important to VMware. But yeah, look, I mean, I think I would often say, you know, we need everyone to be able to articulate where we're going, right? So scale is important in ICT services. So scale is important. We want it to be a really good place to work. IT as a sector has a lot of turnover. So we want people to stay with us and to retain that knowledge. We want to grow. We want to grow profitably. And that creates opportunities for all of us. And, you know, at the moment, we have a lot of momentum behind, you know, our three verticals, which is public sector, financial services and life sciences, and a lot of really good things happening. So yeah, look, I think we know where we want to go to, and everybody knows what they need to do to help us.
When it comes to developing people, right, you've gone from a very prescribed and structured environment to something that's quite different, right? So, you know, what have been the major observations between, say, between the two for you, and is there a crossover that you can bring one to the other?
Yeah, I mean, I think do you mean like the training contract model in accountancy? There's a little bit of a comparison. So with our managed services part of our business, about 100 people in that business, and it's 500 people in total. You have a level one engineer, level two engineer, level three engineer, right? So it's not as structured as a training contract, but it's similar, right? And then they can either stay in managed services or go into one of the other practices, mm-hmm. which is a deeper area. So there are some similarities. I would agree with you, it's not as structured, mm-hmm. and it is harder to keep people. And one of the things we try and do is to try and make sure that we have, you know, really, really good training and really, really good, for especially our younger people, a path, a career path for them that they can stay. Very difficult in recent years, particularly in IT. Just, you know, if you have a year, if you have 12 months experience, someone can offer you like kind of ridiculous money.
You're almost an expert.
Yeah. And so it has been hard because you can't compete with that. Mm-hmm. Some of the salaries that are on offer. And look, the big tech in Dublin has been a brilliant thing. You know, LinkedIn, mm-hmm. Meta, Google. But it definitely distorted the market for
an awful lot of indigenous businesses.
Yeah, for sure.
And then when you look at that, is your preference to develop from within or to try to parachute in people?
I'd always say a bit of both. Okay. It's something we used to do in Grant Thornton quite well, right? Which is, you know, a bit like the soccer analogy. You need your training academy, right? Mm-hmm. You need your players coming through the academy. But then you need to kind of shake things up with a transfer in every once in a while. Yeah. And, you know, I would have always had a thing, you know, you should be meeting a competitor for coffee once a month. You should be meeting potential lateral hires once every 2 weeks, you know, as just a recurring thing to see what's happening. So I would say a mix. Right. Mix is the best.
And is it the same in Ergo's business?
We've brought in, like, we've got brilliant, two good examples would be the head of our productivity practice, Sean McAvenue, came through the desk route.
Right.
So he started as a level one and now he's an MVP and the best in the country. But in the last 12 months, we brought in Sheila McMahon, head of public sector in Vodafone. She came in as a big transfer, if you like. That's a good example of both. Yeah. And I think it works well. You know, I think it works well.
And then that thing you mentioned earlier on, that you're trying to train people and give them all the best training you can, but there's always the risk that they leave. Is that just a risk of doing business, that you train them up and somebody else poaches them on you?
Yeah, I think so. I don't have the stats to hand, but I would say our retention is better than our peers, right? So it's definitely a thing with us. Mm. We do have a very strong culture and, you know, you want people to stay. Mm-hmm. You know, you want people to stay because they've a lot of knowledge about the clients, about the services. I think we're good at that. Right. I think that's one of our strengths. We're not great at everything, right, but we're good at that.
Right. And you mentioned culture. What has been the difference as you step into the role of CEO in Ergo or the role of managing partner in Grant Thornton? What's been the difference about modifying or tweaking the culture that was there before?
Yeah, I think you're trying to create a winning culture, right? A winning team. So you're trying to work on with everyone, you know, are we just going to accept, like, are we going to keep trying to win work and lose? Are we all going to accept that? I used to say, so at one stage, you know, if we lost a pitch, it was like as if we were having cucumber sandwiches. You know, that was a tough loss.
Yeah.
And I would say, should we not be all, you know, fuming here? And you kind of have to make sure that everyone's sort of on the same page. Mm. You know, that we refuse to lose. That we're in this to win it, and that's for all of us. Mm. Yeah. And if any one person, if we have seven people as part of a pitch, they need to feed into a pitch and say three are going to do the pitch in person, like, we have to leave everything there.
Yeah.
You know, we can't, if we lose it, we lose it, but...
We don't want to lose it because we didn't give it our,
yeah,
our
exactly,
best.
Exactly, yeah, exactly, exactly.
Yeah. And so, to what extent then has fear of failure been a driving force for you through your career?
Huge, yeah. Yeah. I think it's a fear of failure is huge for everyone, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it is, but I think it can be a twin-edged sword. There's an awful lot of people who, I suppose, don't want to fail, but don't mind if they do, because they don't see it as a massive step back if they fail. So they kind of, when you're talking to a lot of entrepreneurs, they're just going to keep on going and going and going. They don't want to fail, but they don't think it's the end of the world if they do fail in a thing.
Yeah, I mean, I think fear of failure is huge, you know. Is it fear of failure, or is it that you want to achieve something? I think, for me, when I look back at my 22 years in Grant Thornton, I'm hugely proud of being part of the growth.
Mm.
And I'm hugely proud of everything we achieved at the time. It's got on to even better things now and continues to grow. But from where we were, you know, like I would have gone into meetings where people wouldn't have known who we were. That doesn't happen now.
Yeah.
You know, there's huge satisfaction with that. I think this, it's the same with Ergo. You know, it's we're trying to go somewhere, and I would always say, look, regardless of promotions and money, and all of that stuff, but wouldn't it be good to look back on a period, say, of 5 or 10 years, and said, we were all here when it was this size, and look at it now, and to be part of that, and you can't. Thank, you know, the head office in New York, or whatever.
You're masters of your own destiny at this point.
We build this with our own hands.
Yeah. Oftentimes when you talk about services business and the like, you know, there's that idea that customers are great at telling you what's wrong with something without necessarily telling you what the solution is. And obviously part of the business that Ergo does is finding solutions to customers. So in terms of that approach to customers and to problem solving, what do you think separates Ergo from maybe some of its competitors?
Yeah, I think... And this isn't me just saying this, right? So people who have joined us in the last few years have said, from different companies, big and small, have said, my God, you're very client-centric here. You know, the last place I worked, they didn't even like their clients. So that is one thing that we definitely are and have been. You know, in the past, maybe a tiny bit subservient to clients. I think it has to be sort of a parent-to-parent type relationship, but we're very, very client-centric. And it's really, really important. I think, in fairness, John Purdy always had a thing around, we don't sell customers' services or solutions. We listen to what the problems are, and then we help them. Yeah, we help them.
Yeah. Switching to you obviously were chairman, and then you became CEO of Ergo. What has been the noticeable difference, I suppose, being a chairman and then being a CEO to the same organisation?
I was non-executive chairman. John Purdy came to me in 2015 and said, look, I'd love you to come on as chair. That wasn't straightforward. We were auditor. Grant Thornton were auditors at the time. So to resign as auditors, go through professional standards, da-da-da-da. So it wasn't straightforward, but I kind of liked the idea. And when I went in first, it was great. Things that I'd learned in the previous 20 years was real value add there as a non-exec chair. But you're a non-exec chair, you know? So, you know, like I would have learned...
You're sitting in the front seat but not at the steering wheel, so to say.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I mean, I would have learned, say, in the 2 months that I became CEO, you know, you're really in it. You know, you're really in the middle of the savannah, in the middle of the thing then, and all of the issues and things you need to face. So they're different roles, you know. I enjoy both. I'm chair of other companies now as well, and I enjoy that role, but it's very different. I mean, the CEO ultimately the CEO is also responsible for. The, the financial performance of the company. You have to take responsibility for that. You're not responsible as a non-exec chair for the financial performance.
And in that vein, I suppose, how important is it then that your capital investors are aligned to your view of the company as you take over as that CEO?
Yeah. Stakeholders are really, really important. Whether it's your legal advisors, your auditors, your bankers, you know, your clients and your people. You have to try and tell the story and make sure everyone knows it and is on board. In our case with Ergo, we had great support from AIB. We banked with AIB for 30 years, but they really support us in the last few years. You know, Cathy Bryce, the head of corporate banking in AIB, has been really, really good to us and great support and believe in us. So, I think alignment is important among everyone, you know, so.
It's not just the investors.
Yeah.
Do you obsess about the small things?
No.
No. Because you can't change them or because they're not necessarily important? Or it's somebody else's job to obsess about
no,
them?
No, I wouldn't say that. I have a quote that everyone is desperately tired of me saying, which is a Jack Welch quote, which is anyone can run a business in the short term, anyone can run it for the long term. It's doing both at the same time. So I try and you try and spend your time looking at both what's going to change things next week, but also what's going to change things next year. So if you're constantly obsessing about small things, I don't think you can do that. Yeah. So no, I wouldn't say I mean certain things would bother me, you know. Yeah. Like, you know, if I get invited to a meeting and there's too many people in it, so you know it's going to be a desperate meeting.
Talk and chop.
Yeah,
it.
Desperate
nothing,
meeting.
Nothing decided.
Yeah, you know, and you know, or things like, you know, there's no tea or coffee for a client when they come in, or so like things like that would drive me mad. Yeah. But I'm not constantly going around in an OCD type way about everything.
The idea, and obviously having grown at Grant Thornton, and as you start out in this path with Ergo, the idea out there that the bigger you get, the level of innovation or service falls. So, you know, how do you stop that? And as you look to Ergo, what are the flags that you want to make sure that don't appear that to say that that's going to happen?
Yeah, I don't know whether I would agree that the bigger you get, service falls. I think it's about matching the right service provider to the right client. Mm-hmm. Right? If you get that bit right, I don't think service should necessarily fall. We just commissioned a report where a lot of our clients were interviewed and vendors were interviewed and competitors were interviewed. It was really interesting. You know, how everyone perceives us. And, you know, a big thing nowadays is to look at your net promoter score and to make sure that your service levels aren't dropping. Obviously, there's no net promoter score back in the day, yeah. Right? Back in the day, you'd go out and have, you know, you'd meet your clients for coffee and just ask them, you know? But every single time I ever meet a client, I ask them ask him or her how the service is. Mm. You know,
how do you feel about what you've done already in the company? And if I was to put it in the baseball analogy, what innings do you think you're in terms of your plan?
I think we're definitely past. Is it baseball or cricket?
Baseball.
I think we're probably in between first and second base.
Okay.
I'm in the company 2.5 years. We bought two companies. We've opened up in Northern Ireland. We have made huge strides in our public sector practice. We've made huge strides in financial services. But we've a long way to go. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, there's still a good road to travel. We need to improve some of our practice areas. Certain practices were market leaders. So if we don't go overseas, we won't grow. So that's a challenge in itself. It's one thing being a big dog in Ireland. It's a different thing with a market entry, a market entry strategy, say, into the UK or to Holland or Belgium. So we've a long way to go. And what I'm really happy about is the team we've assembled. We've a really, really good mix, if you like, back to what you earlier said about homegrown and people we've brought in. So, you know, if you have the right team, that's half the work.
And when you look at that strategy, does it depend on the business in terms of whether it's going to be organic or M&A that's going to be required to get you to the places you want to be?
Yeah, I mean, I think for Northern Ireland, we decided to open ourselves and leverage off our reputation. Vendors like Microsoft are all Ireland, so you can leverage off your reputation in ROI with Microsoft in the north. In terms of mainland UK, I think will be by acquisition. I don't think we'll open up an office in London or Manchester and start from scratch. I think we will buy. I think we will buy in the practice areas that we're really strong in, which would be managed services using our ServiceNow platform, or say maybe Dynamics or productivity, Microsoft productivity. So it depends. It'll depend. I think Northern Ireland was easier. It was easy to do it organically. UK, I'd say it'll be M&A.
And do you think from that perspective, given the strength of the relationships you have with the big providers like Microsoft and Dell's and things like that, will they be a furtive ground in terms of insight into who the decent players are in the UK and things like that?
Yeah, and they have been, you know, we have, we've spoken to, you know, say in the context of Microsoft, we've spoken to many different good Microsoft folks from Europe and the UK. I think they're always a help. Ultimately, though, you have to take the chance, right? Yeah. It's your money. And you have to place the bet, you know.
What percentage of your success would you say is due to luck, and what's hard work?
I'd say 80-20, I'd say.
Yeah, I'll take luck every time, I have to say. You know, so as another podcast person said to me, the harder I work, the luckier I get.
Yeah,
so I'm
going
to take that one.
Yeah.
Obviously, given your career between grants and now, what have you learned from other executives or companies along the way?
Everything. I would say I've learned everything. I mean, I started in KPMG. I trained in restructuring in KPMG. My partner was Ray Jackson. I just had lunch with him at Christmas. I learned so much from him. He was exceptionally bright man, very, very loyal, would defend his team to the death. And back then, it was a bit like we were all very, very close.
Mm-hmm.
It was like a cult. And I ended up marrying someone from the team and all of that. So I learned a lot from Ray. When I joined Grant Thornton, Paul Raleigh took a big interest in me. We were trying to grow the practice. And I would have learned about connection and sales from him. And he was very, very good at practice development. I would have watched how he grew practices. I think you learn all the time, don't you, from people around you and clients even. Like I look back on some of my clients over the years, because your clients become your friends, right?
Yeah.
And I would have learned a lot from them. Like I ended up joining Ergo because of John Purdy. And so, I think every day is a learning day that way.
And who do you seek advice from now? Is it the same, or do you have a wider network that you seek?
Yeah, I'd say the people I would seek advice from now. I'd seek advice from Paddy Dillon in Grant Thornton, and probably Steve Tennant in Grant Thornton. I'd talk to them before I'd make any big decisions about anything.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of interesting. They're younger than me now, but I would have maybe given them advice back in the day. Yeah. You know, things kind of...
It kind of has to be that two-way...
It turns around over time, yeah.
How do you keep yourself informed? What do you read? What do you look at, listen?
Yeah, this is where I sound very uncool. I read all of the business books and, yeah, like, I wish I could just go in and read a fiction book, but no, I'm normally reading, you know, something like Shoe Dog or the latest business book.
I've read a very good one, the Thorndike, I call Martin Thorndike, about capital allocation. It's a really, really good book.
Oh, yeah.
I haven't read it. I would say you should read it.
Yeah, very good.
When did you know, or how did you know it was the right time to leave roles in the past in terms of just moving on in your career?
Well, I mean, in terms of leaving KPMG, I went travelling.
Yeah,
so that was easy. That was the decision. Yeah. Went to Australia for a year. I mean, look, leaving Grant Thornton was the hardest thing, you know, you'll ever do.
Yeah.
I don't know, it might be like you know, if you ever thought about leaving Davies, it would be very, very hard. And look, the thought process is difficult. But I think there is a bit of a freedom in it. Yeah. Once you actually do...
Make the decision,
yeah. You know. And sort of, I suppose from my perspective, you know, I left on really, really good terms.
Yeah.
I go back in there and it's...
That's, you know, almost the key, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
Never burn bridges.
Yeah. And look, I'd say it's different if you were forced out somewhere or, you know, it didn't end well. Look, I love my time there. I still love the farm. But I'm also really glad I left when I did. And that, you know, I would have petered out in there, you know, and that's, I wasn't ready for that. Mm.
You mentioned earlier that one piece of advice you'd give younger people is to get that finance or accountancy qualification. What other advice would you give to young people now?
Ooh, have a go.
Mm-hmm.
I would say to try and seek out a mentor as well. I think I'm a big believer in, you look back on your life and people give you a hand at different junctures, you know. So, you know, try and encourage someone to take an interest in you, if you know what I mean. I think that's important. Have a go. I would also say, like, it's amazing when I talk to young people, they tell you what salary they're going to be on. Like, it's completely irrelevant.
Yeah.
It's completely irrelevant. And I think a lot of young people make decisions for $3,000 extra and it's a complete wrong job.
Yeah.
And you can see it.
Yeah. It's almost like a slow motion car crash.
Yeah.
You know it's going to end badly.
Like, can you not see if you stayed there you'd learn so much more and you're going to be, you know, earning so much more as a result of that.
Yeah.
So I think just open to experience and open to and look for the right roles, you know, don't look at the salaries, look for the right roles.
And the learning opportunities.
And the learning opportunity. Yeah, it's all about.
Yeah. Now, final question. Opening up the book.
Oh, very good.
Look at it. Right. Who has been the greatest influence towards your career?
I would say Paul Raleigh. Paul Raleigh was, I'd say, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Paul took an interest in me. He went to bat and put me forward for partnership in Grant Thornton when I was 30 years of age. And, you know, he would have been a big influence and supporter of mine. So, yeah, he'd be the biggest influence.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's it for this episode of Everyday Business with Aidan Donnelly. I would just like to thank my guest, Paul McCann. Don't forget to like, share and subscribe or comment if you enjoyed what you heard. Many thanks and see you next time.
The participants in this podcast have done so for the purpose of sharing their own individual business experiences. Some are clients of Davy and some are not. They have not received a gratuity or other payment for their time in making the podcast. The views expressed throughout are their own. Warning, the information in this podcast is not a recommendation or investment research. It does not purport to be financial advice. You should speak to your advisor in the context of your own personal circumstances prior to making any financial or investment decision. In the Republic of Ireland, J&E Davy Unlimited Company, trading as Davy and Davy Private Clients, is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland. Davy is a Davy Group company and also a member of the Bank of Ireland Group. In the United Kingdom, Davy Private Clients UK, Davy UK and Davy Capital Markets UK are the trading names of J&E Davy UK Limited. J&E Davy UK Limited is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. J&E Davy UK Limited is a Davy Group company and also a member of the Bank of Ireland Group.